This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
To me, it's like the tail wags the dog. Like, as long as the stock market's fine, everything's good. So it's an important signaling mechanism, but is it reality? And that's where I think the story's gone off the rails.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average. What does this omnipresent ticker in the corner of our TV screens really mean? Is it a gauge of our country's economic health, an indication of corporate growth, or something else? This week on Sea Change Radio, we discuss the Dow and the stock market as a whole with economic researcher Chris Martinson. The co-founder of Peak Prosperity, Martinson talks about how our obsession with the Dow helps the investor class, describes the economic indicators that environmentalists should be looking at, and weighs in on whether it's okay to root for the Dow to go down. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Martinson. He is the co-founder of Peak Prosperity. Chris, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Alex, it's so good to be back with you and your listeners today.
So first, why don't you tell us what Peak Prosperity does, Chris? You're an economic researcher and futurist. What does that mean exactly?
Well, futurist is maybe a fancy term. The more correct one would be extrapolator. And what I mean by that is Peak Prosperity is founded around this concept, a set of ideas where we look at the data and we say, you know, where are we in this story? And so we look at the economy, energy, and environment or ecology all as one system. And we believe that you can't look at the parts in isolation anymore. You know, you got your central banks going, oh, rubbing their hands like, oh, we'll just get the economy roaring over here without understanding what's happening in the ecological space or the energy space. So when you put all three of these things together, it says, look, massive change is coming. We can all feel it. And the mission of Peak Prosperity is to create a world worth inheriting. And we do that by educating people. And we want people to take that education and turn it into actions. And so we recommend all different kinds of actions that we think people should be taking to make themselves more resilient today, maybe a little happier too. And it's all organized around this idea that the current way that we have our economic machine running is completely unsustainable. But ultimately, I'm a guy who likes data. I've got kids. I care about the future. And I might be wrong, but I'm not confused. I think we're headed in a direction that ends very badly if we keep going too much longer.
One of the reasons I reached out to you is because I had a Facebook discussion with a friend who she follows the Dow as kind of her benchmark of how the economy is doing. And she's not a fan of President Trump, nor am I. And she was rooting for it to stay up. And I said, is it wrong to be rooting against the Dow? Why don't you lay out what the Dow Jones means and maybe kind of summarize the moral quandary you may have when you look at things like the S&P 500 or the Dow?
Yeah, it's a complex question with a lot of pieces we could unpack. So let me just sidestep the moral argument, because there we have to have a time frame. So would it be bad for somebody who's just about to hit retirement age, they've worked their whole lives, they've played into the game just like they're supposed to, and now they have all their holdings and stocks, and gosh, they would just really prefer that they stayed up and not go down. Yeah, from that person's perspective, I totally get the point of view. Like, yeah, these things should keep going higher, right? But from a longer-term perspective, we have to understand that stocks themselves are not actual wealth. They're claims on wealth. And so when we say, how does Apple or Amazon or General Electric, how do they actually generate wealth, or General Motors, right? Well, look, it's pretty simple. The economic machinery is where you take resources out of the natural world. It might be sand that we somehow melt down and turn into silicon wafers that becomes, you know, really high value added chips that becomes the components of the brain of my iPhone, right? But that's what business is. We take resources out of the world, we add value to them, people buy them. The markers for that, the way we measure that is in dollars, it's in stocks and bonds. Those are the financial assets. So those are claims. And at heart, though, this idea, which is very heavily marketed by Wall Street, it's very much a retail sort of an idea, is this idea that stocks always have to go up, you know? And so let's just peel that back. I like to do this by playing a game called So Then What? So let's say that stocks right now, they're trading at very, very expensive multiples. You know, they have price earnings that are through the roof by any conventional measure. And the way that those stocks are going to have value, though, over time is if they can grow to justify those price earnings, right? So to say we want stocks to double in price from here, well, either we want them to get twice as expensive relative to their actual value, or we're saying we need the economy to be twice as big so we can justify having twice as many claims on this thing. Either way, what we're really saying when we say we need stocks to go up always is we're saying we believe in this idea of infinite growth. Now, when you wander with me over to another E in this story and we wander away from just how much our stock's worth, which again is a very narrow view of this whole thing. And by the way, Trump holds that narrow view. So does the Federal Reserve. They're all captives to having the stock market go up. They've hitched a lot of political capital to that idea. But when you step out here into the real world, you go, okay. But ultimately, an economy is not a thing. It's a subset of something. It's a subset of the natural world. And so we have to ask the question, is there enough sand out there? Is there enough oil or energy out there to manufacture all these things? Is there enough food? Is there enough water, fresh water? It's there. These are the components which I hope everybody can agree, if we didn't have any water or air, if we were Venus, right, you know, with an 800 degree surface temperature, we'd realize that we have nothing. You know, we've got this barren rock you can't live on. So we need the natural world, and every single warning sign that I track, which includes where we are with respect to soils, water, energy resources, insect populations, amphibians, all species, whatever you care about, birds, all of those are in really severe decline right now and flashing bright red warning signs. And so to this person who you're having the conversation with, I would ask a follow-up question, which is, hey, we have only less than half the animals and birds that we had just 40 years ago on the planet. If you wanted stocks to go up for the next 40 years in the way they have, would you be willing to cut that number in half again? And okay, so they say, yeah, that'd be okay. I'd be willing to lose half the birds and mammals. That's totally, if they're that kind of person.
As long as my IRA is good.
Yeah, my IRA is higher. And then, see, that's why I like to play the so then what? So then I say, well, so do you have any kids, any grandkids? Well, so would we be willing to go another half? Would we be willing to lose the 50% of the few that remain as a next doubling in this story? And you play that game out a few times, and people eventually get to the point where you go, now there's no life on Earth, but your stocks are worth 100 times as much. So then what? You know, and then they hopefully go to that logical conclusion. They go, well, that would be bad. You know, and I hope we could all agree. Many people are waking up, Alex, now to the point that we're already there in this story, right? So that's part one. Part two is by constantly doing what the central banks have done, what the Federal Reserve has done. They specifically set out on a program to make stocks go higher, to make bonds go higher, to make real estate go higher, because these are financial assets. And their theory was, hey, if these go up, everybody's richer. And if everybody's richer, they'll spend more. And if they spend more, we have more economy. And that's all they're measuring for is, do we have enough people working and are they paying their taxes, right? So that's all cool. However, what they did as an idea has not been borne out in the data. What actually happens when you print money and throw it into the stock and bond and real estate markets is you enrich one group of people at the expense of another. Because that's all central banks can do. They don't create wealth. They sit there and they clack on their little keyboards and they make fantasy digits go out that represent dollars and they drive up the prices of things. And so, you know, when they do that, and Bill Gates' net worth doubles, right? He's now worth $40 billion instead of 20 or whatever the numbers are, right? The first question you should ask is, well, where'd that extra $20 billion come from? Because it had to come from somewhere. It represents real purchasing power. Trust me, Bill Gates can whip out $20 billion of extra purchasing power, but did the Federal Reserve actually create purchasing power? No, they had to take it from somebody and give it to somebody else. So let's look at who lost in this story. I love to play this game too. Who's the loser? Because if there were all these 0.1% people who are gaining because their financial assets went up so much in price, the next question is, well, who lost it? Because here's the thing that's always confused in the media about our markets. They pretend as if they create wealth. Oh my God, the stock market doubled. we are all twice as wealthy. But it's not how these things work, because real wealth comes out of the ground. So here's how we play this game. We say, well, look at all, you know, bonds, you know, the people who held the bonds are now fantastically rich because they went up so much in price. The yields collapsed to zero, below zero in some cases. Who's the loser in this story? All you have to do is crack your newspaper and find out pensions getting destroyed, endowments, savers, granny got thrown under the bus. She's getting nothing on her bank account. Everybody listening to this, how much are you getting in interest on your bank accounts? It's peanuts. It's way below the rate of inflation. So you're losing. By having money in a bank, you are losing. Who decided who was going to that you were going to lose that? Well, that was the Federal Reserve. They made the decision. Okay, so if they decided I was going to lose, who did they decide should gain? Oh, well, that would be the people on the other side of that transaction, the big banks and the holders of all those financial assets. So that's what they did.
And they may rationalize that saying, well, we're actually just trying to stimulate investment. We want people to get their money out of CDs in the bank and put that money to stimulate the quote-unquote economy. But as you say, it's not just the economy. It's corporate America in a lot of ways. It's these bigger corporations that they want investors to see that the paltry returns from their savings account in the bank are not as enticing as the possibility of doubling or tripling your money in the stock market.
Well, absolutely. And so what they've tried to do is, and a lot of people have bought into this idea that they've eliminated risk from the stock market. Buy the dip has been an absolutely powerful strategy. You can't lose. It's always going to go up. If it does start to go down, the central banks will step in and make sure it doesn't go down. They'll do that in both word and deed. You know, every time the stock market literally is down 1%, you see the Federal Reserve trots out a new official to go, well, we're thinking of being easing some soon, maybe this afternoon. You know, it's just crazy how much focus is on the stock market. To me, it's like the tail wags the dog. Like, as long as the stock market's fine, everything's good. So it's an important signaling mechanism, but is it reality? And that's where I think the story's gone off the rails.
Is that also mutual funds that kind of gives people the illusion of safety? That it's all this one big pool, and so what could possibly go wrong? You're kind of insured. But we saw what happens with pools of mortgages in 2008, 2009, didn't we?
Yeah, risk turns out does not get evaporated. It doesn't get shot into outer space, never to be seen again. It's distributed, but it's still there. And when it finally comes roaring back, you discover, oh, it's still here. But people were pretending as if risk went away completely. So really the larger sweep of this story, the piece that I want to boil it down to your friend's comment is simply this. The Fed picked winners and losers. You could do worse than to say capital is the winner in this story. So those who already have capital or who have access to it, they're the winners. Who's the losers? Labor. Now, how would we detect this in the statistics? Oh, that's easy. The median household, 50% of households do not have $500. 50% of all households do not have access to $500 for an emergency. They are living hand to mouth. These are people who go out, work hard, have a paycheck. They're getting killed by inflation, which is much higher than we're officially told. And you can see all the tent cities popping up, you know, all over L.A. And there's poop in the streets in San Francisco. You see it in the suicide statistics, the opiate epidemic. All of these are coincident. But I think there's an explanation for them is we're having a hard time. And the reason for that is the central bank of the United States, but also across the world, they decided that labor, that the average person, that the middle class, that the household was going to be the loser in this story. Capital was going to be the winner under exactly the theory you espoused, which is, well, geez, if we had more capital over here, capital does good stuff. It invests, it produces increases in productivity, and it creates jobs. That's the theory. The problem is, by making so much financial engineering so easy to do, they put all this money over into capital, waved their magic voodoo wand. We're waiting for awesome things to happen. You know what happened instead? The companies are like, dude, I can take dividends, stocks that are yielding a 2.5% dividend, borrow money at 1%, buy those stocks back. Dude, I make free money. So companies have been incentivized to do financial engineering, not invest in property, plant, or equipment, or raise wages, or do any of that stuff. They've been financially incentivized to do stuff. And here's Warren Buffett's right-hand man, Charlie Munger, said it best. And I love this quote. He said, you show me the incentive, I'll show you the outcome. We're all humans, just operate by incentives. So the central bank created an incentive structure for corporations to go out and financially engineer stuff. Big banks did horrible things. None of them went to prison. and they got light slaps on the wrist. So they were incentivized to keep doing that. Trust me, when the next crisis comes, we're going to find out the banks have been just as bad as they ever were. Why? Because they didn't get in trouble. So this is not a hard story to follow, but the daily drumbeat in the news is Dow went up. That's good. And it's arguably not good when you just look at the data, right? The household data I just told you, the suicide data, the opiate epidemic data. Those are all signs to say this isn't good. Something's not quite right here. And the biggest thing that happened in all this is the Federal Reserve also said we're going to elevate capital over labor. But here's the other thing they did. They said we're picking boomers over millennials, right? Because the boomers are the ones who actually hold all those stocks, the bonds, and most of the real estate. So we've seen really pathetic household formation. And like, oh my God, boomers, they live in their parents' basements far too much. They're not, I don't know, they don't want to start families. It's like, dude, because houses are 1.3 million in San, you can't start in San Francisco. You need five times the median income to afford the median house out there. You can't do it. So it doesn't happen. So who won, who lost? That's the thing I really have been trying to educate people about, at least on one thing at Peak Prosperity, is this. With the Federal Reserve's picking winners and losers. You already know if you're a winner or a loser in this story. It's very easy. Is your income five times what it was 10 years ago or not? If it is, congratulations, you're a winner. If it's not, you are part of the loser class. I hate to be that blunt, but that's how the game is being played. Funky.
Hey, listen to the man.
Rap Godfather.
Payback.
Cold-blooded.
People, people, gotta get over before we go under. Down, Lord. People, people, we gotta get over before we go under. Hey, country, you didn't say what you meant. You just changed a brand new funky president. Stock market going up, jobs.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Chris Martinson. He is the co-founder of Peak Prosperity. Folks can go to peakprosperity.com to learn more about what he does. We're talking about the history of the Dow. It's important to remember that the Dow hovered in the sub-1000s for a lot of the 70s and the 80s, and it hit 1000 in 1982, and then it doubled, tripled. Basically, it went from 1000 to 3000 from 82 to 92. But then by 1999, it had gotten up to 11,000. And besides the dip at the end of George W. Bush's administration, it's just gone up since 1980. So Chris, what if the Dow were at 10,000 in the next 6 months? Walk us through what that would mean. Would it really just affect the sea level class, or would this trickle down to hurt everyday Americans in a profound way?
No, it'll hurt profoundly, and for a couple of reasons. One of the biggest ones is that one of the other incentivized outcomes that has happened over time is that pensions have these actuarial sort of tables that they have to fulfill. They have a certain amount of assets. They've got a certain pool of people. They know how long these people live. They know what they've promised them. It's a math problem. You balance the whole thing out. The problem for the pensions, and by which I mean state pensions, municipal, local, stuff like that. This could include CalPERS in California, the Teachers Fund in Chicago. These are affect everybody because there's pensions, public pensions in every single state. And in order to begin balancing their books, they couldn't possibly do it with, you normally, historically, would have a 60-40 split, 60% in bonds, 40% in stocks or other assets. And they did that because you can calculate exactly what's going on with the bonds, and you need to make sure your returns match what your future liabilities are going to be. So that worked for decades and decades, but starting with the quantitative easing programs that upended this whole story in 2008, the pensions found, geez, we can't make our books work with the bonds at yielding these really low yields. What do we do? Well, guess what? They did exactly what you just described before. They got herded over into risk assets. So now that 60-40 has been completely inverted. Public pensions are now 60% in stocks and they're 40% in bonds. which means that if Dow went to 10,000, they would all basically implode. And by the way, they're going to implode anyway because they're still assuming mostly around 7% returns, which you're not getting, even at a 60-40 stock bond split, because the bond portion is at 3%, 2, 1, or even 0, or even negative. Right? So it's not working out. Math problems there. And so when we run into these pension problems, let's use Chicago. Illinois has a state constitution that has embedded in the state constitution that you can't make changes to the promised output from those pensions. So without amending the state constitution, it's impossible for the legislatures or for the mayor's office or for any of the pension boards to do anything other than pay what they promised they were going to pay. The problem is they're so far upside down that they are just losing money like crazy, and they're in the sad position now of having to top up their pension plans with taxpayer money. So in Cook County, Illinois, which is where Chicago is, they've been doing that. They've had to raise taxes. As they've raised taxes, they've actually lost businesses, lost the people who could afford to move typically. These happen to also be your highest taxpayers. The more that happened, the more they've had to raise taxes, and they're caught in this really bad spiral. If the Dow went to 10,000, that spiral would accelerate. And, this sounds dire. Truthfully, what we're going to get is a central banker bailout of the pensions at some point. Because, I think hopefully under the you break it, you buy it philosophy, they've ruined the pensions. They've enriched the corporate class. They've enriched the capital class. But they've really taken that, again, winners and losers. The losers in this story have been the pensions, have been the endowments. So colleges are particularly the smaller ones with small endowments, just crushed here. And the pensions, just crushed. So that's an easy prediction to make, because we're going to get in a lot of trouble.
When you say they, are you talking about the central bank, the Fed?
Yeah, they did this on purpose. They knew, if I can conceive of this and you can, trust me, it's not a difficult concept for them to manage either, which is when we drive interest rates down, certain things are going to happen. On the plus side, we hope more people are going to undertake more economic activity. They're going to borrow money. They're going to buy new cars. They're going to buy new homes. They're going to put a new kitchen in. That's what they say. That's the plus side. But they never talk about, Alex, they don't talk about the minus side. What's the minus side? Well, we're going to incentivize a bunch of C-suite financial shenanigans. We're going to incentivize leveraging corporate balance sheets to levels that could be really painful if they have to unwind. We're also going to be purposely destroying pensions. And anybody who is a saver has, by the way, there's about a missing $1.5 trillion of interest income that would have gone to savers. Now, these would have been a lot of boomers. They have bank accounts. They would have been earning 5% instead of 0 or 1 or whatever at the bank. But that missing $1.5 trillion that normally would have gone to new business, small business formation as that capital accumulated and was passed on to children and grandchildren. So we've seen really low levels of new business formation because there's a missing $1.5 trillion. But again, missing as if, oh, nature took it away. No, it was transferred. Who got the $1.5 trillion? Well, kind of went to the bankers, right? And so these are all things that the Federal Reserve specifically did, knowingly did. And I've been on a little bit of a crusade to get, shake people by the lapels and say, these are really serious policy decisions. They have political ramifications. They have social, they have generational ramifications, also ecological ramifications, and nobody's asking the right questions. That, the Federal Reserve Jerome Powell gets in front of the Senate and they're like, Jerome, you've done well, tell everybody how great you've done it, keeping, the economy and the stock market growing, and he answers that softball. But nobody says, Jerome, 5 people now have as much wealth as half the world. That used to be a number like 500 people had as much wealth as half the world. Your policies have been driving that dynamic. Tell us, how far is too far? Or is there no limit? Will you stop if and only if one entity owns the entire world and everybody's in debt slavage to that person? I mean, this is a question that really ought to be asked and would have been asked even a generation ago, but we don't ask them anymore.
But the Federal Reserve has a limit to what they can do in terms of economically transforming our society. They have their levers and they're very important. And that's something that you know a lot more about than I do. But let's say you were advising the next president of the United States and they said, Chris, we agree with your general philosophy that the Fed is screwing things up. We want to try to rectify the gross inequity in our economy. How do we strengthen the middle class?
what would be, you know, your top line advice for that candidate?
Well, the first thing is we have to stop squandering the energy resources. So it's an absolute shame that we're ripping shale oil and gas out of the ground as fast as we are, and that the top three selling vehicles are the F-150, the Silverado, and the Tahoe. Right? That's just wrong. We need an energy policy that actually aligns incentives with outcomes. It's a shame that we still have buildings being built with, you know, minimal insulation in the walls and ceilings. It's just wrong. So we know better. We can stop that. The second thing is it's time. It's absolutely time to tip the balance back in favor of labor over capital. Capital's won the whole game. They won. Let's just admit it. Capital won. And they've taken everything. And guess what? They haven't really been giving it back. You know, so that didn't work out. That whole noblesse oblige thing kind of went by the wayside. So the next president really, really needs to understand that the true source of productivity in this country has been its natural resources and having a healthy and robust middle class. And that means that labor has to have some piece of this pie. Too much has gone to capital, way too much. And so that needs to be reversed in some fashion if anybody actually cares about the middle class. And so, you know, to wander back into dangerous territory with you, if I was advising the Democrats in this regard, something Trump did that they forgot to do last time was he talked to, whether it was lip service and that it didn't come to pass, doesn't matter. He at least looked at the steel workers, the coal workers, the auto workers. He visited them and said, I see you, I understand your concerns, and I care. Now, what did he do? He put a tax cut that mostly benefited everybody but them, but that's fine. Right. Somebody at least needs to look the middle class in the eye and say, you know what? You do matter, you know, and I understand that. And here's how, you know, I understand it. And here's what I'm going to do. And I think that would be, you know, there's if we could please have a populace that actually had good intentions rather than bad intentions, that would be fantastic at this stage. Because guess what, Alex? We don't have a lot of time to monkey around and make mistakes over and over again. And that isn't saying humans are horrible. It's just saying this is the reality of the circumstances we find ourselves in. We don't have that many more swings at the plate before we strike out. We've got to get our energy policies right. We've got to get our environmental policies. We've got to understand that the infinite growth model is broken and it was never destined to last forever. Just play so then what, a few iterations and you get there. So we desperately need a real change in things. And you know, that's why, you know, I haven't that's why I do what I do. And that's why I don't spend a lot of time on national politics, because the window of what's polite conversation there is too small, given where we actually are in this story.
He's the co-founder of Peak Prosperity. People can go to peakprosperity.com to find out more. Chris Martinson. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, my pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Parliament and James Brown. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.